KPCW News, time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Let's find out what's in store for our weather this weekend. Here with a report is Cedric Haynes with the ABC 4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. As we take a look at your forecast, we're going to be featuring mostly sunny skies. The heat is going to be on. We're looking at temperatures jumping back into the low to mid 90s for us today in the Park City area. We're going to be seeing those highs climbing to around 100 degrees in the Heber Valley. Again, mostly sunny skies. Watch out for some of that smoke and haze, particularly over towards the Heber Valley. Otherwise, as we go into your weekend, we're going to stick with the heat. High temperatures in the lower 90s in Park City for us with a mixture of sun and clouds. Partly cloudy skies is what we'll call it for your Saturday. We'll be looking at partly cloudy skies in the Heber Valley with highs in the upper 90s to around 100 degrees once again. As we go into your Sunday, we're looking at partly cloudy skies as well, but we're going to add in just a tinge of moisture. So that means we could have a couple of pop-up showers and storms developing in the afternoon, particularly across the mountain areas. But high temperatures should still make it to the low 90s there in Park City and into the mid to upper 90s in the Heber Valley. Now, that tinge of moisture will be a sign of things to come as we head into next week. We expect our heat dome or high pressure ridge to slide just enough to the south and east to allow us to try to get some monsoon moisture to sneak back into the area. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to be looking at a washout of the forecast heading into next week, but each day will carry with it the chance of isolated showers and thunderstorms. Now, we know these thunderstorms are typically slow moving and they can produce a heavy amount of rainfall in a very short period of time, and that could lead to some isolated flash flooding. So we're going to be watching out for that flash flood threat as we go into next week. But overall, the good news is a slightly better chance of pop-up showers and storms, and that will help with the temperatures. So we'll see those high temperatures dropping back into the mid 80s for high temperatures in the Park City area heading into next week, with highs only in the lower 90s in the Heber Valley. By the time we get towards the end of next week, we could be talking about high temperatures in the low 80s in Park City and upper 80s in the Heber Valley. That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, I'm going to get to chat with Park City Special Events Manager Chris Finney about the road closures and other impacts of this weekend's Kimball Arts Festival, which, as I told you, you can see just all kinds of activity on Main Street getting ready for it. Then meteorologist Alan Smith will call in to discuss the potential for a super El Nino season, something I don't understand, and hopefully he will help us all understand when we chat with him. We're going to finish our hour by speaking with Brian Boudreau and Olympian Kristen Santos Griswold of Park City Speed Skating. The Park City Planning Commission will revisit the 5-acre Bonanza Park proposal on August 12th. KPCW's Christine Weller reports commissioners will discuss building height and traffic mitigation.
The Park City Planning Commission will continue its review of a mixed-use development proposal for the 5-acre Bonanza Park to ensure it meets city code. It will revisit the project August 12th during a public meeting. As proposed, the site would include 106 residential units, including 88 affordable. The ground floor of each building would have commercial facilities, including a restaurant, cafe, and arts spaces. About 2 acres in the center of the site, or 62%, are set aside as open space with a small amphitheater, playground, and lawn space. Since its first look at the proposal in June, the commission has focused on building height. 6 of the 7 buildings are above the zoned 35-foot maximum and above the 40-foot exception allowed for gables. In July, Stephen Swisher with GTS Development said the decorative additions are a nod to Park City's mining roots, but add 5 feet. Swisher said the site's slope is also an issue. With a 120-foot-long building, he said one end can be below the maximum and the other won't. He said it's also difficult to fit a commercial and 2 residential floors under 35 feet.
It is my opinion that some of these code requirements were really not anticipating larger projects, and certainly we're not trying to make the buildings taller because we want to have some grand architectural expression. It's sort of like slope ground plus what it takes to stack those things up.
The commission hasn't decided whether the height is acceptable. Commission Chair Kristen Van Dyne told KPCW July 17th, the group is always concerned about height in town, especially at an entry corridor.
We always emphasize having a project that fits the site, not make the site fit the plan.
The commission will also review a traffic and parking mitigation plan August 12th. As the site is on the corner of 2 busy roads, the plan recommends separating pedestrians and bikes from cars, as well as improving road connections to the nearby Munchkin and Homestake roads. The proposed site's parking garage has 280 stalls and two entrances and exits. Staff has some concerns about a garage entrance on Kearns Boulevard, which the commission may discuss. Van Dyne said the meeting will also include opportunities for public comment.
We always love when we can get public participation, especially at planning commission meetings. We're looking at it through the land management code, so feedback that really kind of addresses that is the most helpful.
Van Dyne said locals can speak in person or virtually or email comments directly to the commission. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
As I mentioned before, the Kimball Arts Festival kicks off tonight. Here to talk about its impact is Park City Special Events Manager, Chris Finney. Morning, Chris.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Chris, as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of activity going on Main Street. About how many artists are we going to see tonight?
We're expecting 195 artists' booths tonight.
And they stretch all the way from the very top of Main Street to all the way to the very bottom, I take it.
Yeah, that's right. So top of Main Street, just as you turn the corner from Sweet onto Main, all the way down to 9th Street.
There are a lot of people out on the street this morning telling you can't park here, you can't drive here. When did they start setting this thing up?
So the police department clears the street at 3 a.m. and they start loading in all the artists about then. It takes a good amount of work from 3 a.m. All the way through this afternoon. We'll put the final emergency equipment in place around 3:30, and then the festival opens at 5 p.m.
You touched on something interesting, because a lot of people just come to the festival, you see the artists, you hopefully buy something or not. But there's a lot of support, a lot of infrastructure that you have to put into place. Obviously, the artists put up their art, but there's a lot of other things going on. Talk to us a little bit about that infrastructure. What else is going on out there?
Yeah, I mean, all these big, large-scale events really touch all the city departments. Public safety is a big helper. They are here clearing the streets, checking for access passes, making sure people aren't parked in the wrong space, as well as keeping our community safe, answering any emergency response calls, etc. Our parking department is working inside China Bridge, as well as all the surface lots, making sure that the artists can park where they park, and the public can come and still find a spot to park as well. Our streets department is out making sure the streets look good, putting out no parking signs where the people shouldn't be parking, making sure that all of our roads look good, street sweeping, etc. I mean, it goes from pretty much top to bottom. Our executive team is out making calls and talking to people. Council members are getting pinged and asked questions. I mean, it's really top to bottom.
And just out of curiosity, when do you start planning for an event like this?
So we start planning in March, and then we end up going to City Council sometime in April, early May, with their supplemental plan, and we get approval from City Council for what they're planning for the year.
So let's get the nuts and bolts out of the way. Where can I drive tonight, and where can I not drive tonight that I could usually drive? Of course, I assume you don't want me to drive at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the best bet. Between the event impacts and the UDOT construction projects that are out on the roads, definitely we are prioritizing transit. So we have a bus lane up on Deer Valley Drive that'll prioritize. So if you're on the bus, you can jump right in that lane and they'll cruise you right up to the Old Town Transit Center. But in general, Park Avenue will be access pass only. So if you live in Park, off of Park Ave in the Old Town area and you have your access pass, you'll be able to get through the checkpoint down there at the Box of Rocks, the intersection of Deer Valley and Park Ave. Otherwise, we'll have one lane on Deer Valley for the bus lane. Sweet Alley will be closed just back of house, so everything that is part of the festival will be on Sweet Alley unless you have an access pass. So if you have off-street parking, if you're a business or a resident who lives on Sweet Alley or Upper Main Street and has a off-street parking spaces, stop by my office if you don't have one, but otherwise you need an access pass to get on a Sweet Alley.
And then in terms of those who choose to try to park here, first of all, what's it going to cost them to park here in China Bridge tonight?
Yeah, so the parking is our event rates. It'll be $9 an hour with a max of 40. That starts today at 10 a.m. and then consecutively tomorrow at 10 a.m. and again on Sunday. pretty much matches up for the rest of the festival with the festival hours. Today, like I said, the festival starts at 5 p.m., but we try to control everything a little bit earlier just so we can keep organized.
And if I wanted, if someone chooses to park in China Bridge and pay that $9 an hour, I take it they can only get in on the Marsac Avenue side?
That's right. We're asking everyone to come in on Marsac Ave, take the top entrance. That it will be the entrance and exit. All the exits on a suite alley will be blocked for back of house.
And if there's public drop-off, if someone wants to get dropped off, is that also the drop-off area up on top of the up on top of China Bridge?
That's right. Thanks for mentioning that. South Marsac lot will be turned into, all the parking spaces will be taken, and there'll be a turnaround up there with a drop-off for all, you know, hotel shuttles, Ubers, Lyfts, anyone who wants to drop off someone.
And I know there's, you talked about transit access and the buses will get through. What satellite parking are you recommending people use to, to take those buses?
So we have the high school lot will be available. That's the Eccles lot, the and then Richardson Flat. And then our resort partners over at Park City Mountain has also offered some parking as well.
So
how transit.
So how frequently will you be running buses from Richardson Flat?
Richardson Flat will be on a 20-minute frequency, and as demand increases, our transit operators
they're watching.
They'll watch it and add a couple trippers if they need to.
And so that's 20 minutes. High school will probably be about the same.
Yep,
same bus.
It's the same bus that passes through there, correct?
And then the resort, is that the normal Park City Transit route?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. We talked about secure. Oh. I know what I wanted to ask you. Bike check. Is there a bike valet or a bike check?
There is a bike valet. It's down on 7th Street. The Kimball has worked with the high school mountain biking team in the last few years, so it's a great opportunity for them to do a fundraiser. So park your bike there. It'll be nice and safe. There'll be a valet that'll park your bike and watch it. And if you tip them, all the tips go right straight to their program.
Okay, what else have I forgotten to ask you about logistics? Have we touched on most of the logistical issues?
Yes, I just wanted to, again, just stress that the construction impacts, you know, we're down to two lanes instead of three lanes in that intersection by Cole Sport and Jan Sport. So just take your time. You know, getting through there might be a little difficult. We are prioritizing transit. Like I said, our free transit access is fantastic. Can't talk enough about how great our transit is. Jump on the bus, especially if you're a local. You know how to get around on the buses or ride your bike. E-bikes are great. I've been riding my e-bike all week. It's actually really, really great to get around and beat the construction.
And the weather's been pretty nice the last day or two. Chris, in addition to art, there's music and there's also some food trucks. How many food trucks did you authorize this year? About?
I think there's about 7 food trucks at the top of Sweet Alley
in the Brew Pub lot.
Yep, so there'll be a satellite stage in the Brew Pub lot. Food, beverages, things like that will be up there. There's also a spirit garden with another stage down on Heber. So intersection of Heber and Main, there's a spirit garden. Bands will be playing there until 9 o'clock tonight.
Okay, Chris. Security? Who sort of organizes the security around the event? And what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so there's the city security and then the Kimball security. So the Kimball has hired their own security, and they will look after a lot of their parking spaces where the artists take place. But most of our security is headed up by our public safety team.
Okay. Anything else on Kimball before we turn to other events?
No, it's going to be a busy weekend. So tonight, you mentioned a little bit of other events. So tonight in general is Locals Night. So it's a free night for anyone in Summit County. To get a ticket and come out and enjoy the festival. But with that comes a lot of crowds and a lot of traffic. And on top of that, we have a Deer Valley concert tonight as well at Snow Park. So again, just take your time, plan ahead, give yourself some extra time, and know when you get there, you're gonna have a lot of fun. So just try to keep a level head.
Wow, the idea that there's a Deer Valley concert with that single lane competing to get to Deer Valley means that you really do want to be thinking twice before trying to take a private vehicle into here tonight.
That's right.
Okay. Other events coming up. What do we got for the rest of the summer, Chris?
We have Song Summits coming up this month. At the end of the month, I think it's the 27th and 28th. We also have Chef's Table, which will be here next weekend. Chef's Table is a Netflix series. It is coming to town to work with some businesses on Main Street, as well as some other the hotels in the area. They're doing a nice food festival, so you can come in for that. And then, you know, as we roll through, we'll have Miner's Day over Labor Day weekend. Looking forward to Halloween, Shot Ski, all of our fall events as well. And then throughout the weeks, we always have some events with Mountain Town Music, puts on some great events at City Park with some local music. And yeah, running races, mountain bike races, things like that.
Well, we'll be doing a segment on Chef's Table Monday on Mountain Money with the producers. So we'll be learning more about that.
Great.
Okay, Chris, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
No, I'd just like to say a big thank you. We touched on all of the city's departments that take place with this and the Kimball staff. The Kimball staff's been great to work with. Everyone's working in conjunction, and it'll be a fun weekend. So, again, have a lot of fun. Plan ahead.
Yeah, with that Deer Valley concert thing, I really think it's going to be pretty miserable to try to drive in here tonight.
Yeah, there's a concert tonight and on Saturday night as well.
Oh, there's one on Saturday night as well. Okay. Chris Finney, Park City Special Events Director, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
The Summit County Council has adopted a set of strategies to make housing more affordable. But as KPCW's Connor Thomas reports, it's not clear how those plans will be executed.
Councilmember Chris Robinson says the specifics of the Summit County Housing Authority's strategic plan look good. But he wonders if the county is serious about implementing them.
I think we're schizophrenic as a county where we set goals. We want 1,500 units. We want have all these aspirational things. But then when we come to do them, we say, well, geez, we don't want any of that. We don't want that. That's going to induce growth.
The council set the goal of approving 1,500 affordable housing units by the end of 2036 last year. That number does not include the former Dakota Pacific, now Six Ridge Partners project in Kimball Junction, or whatever is built on the county-owned Klein Dolly parcel in Jeremy Ranch. So Summit County has not chipped away at its goal. The Housing Authority's plan, which the council voted 4-1 to approve on Wednesday, has some ideas to fix that. The plan says prefabricated homes, accessory dwelling units, and new zoning can increase supply. It suggests the county should buy properties to make them affordable and budget for public-private partnerships annually. Robinson tells his colleagues they should be prepared to receive proposals along those lines.
I don't think it'll be productive to have the Housing Authority come back and or other developers and say, geez, it's even in your strategic plan. You've approved it, and yet you guys don't want to do it.
The last time council members rezoned any land was when they approved 12 townhomes on an overgrown Pine Brook tennis court in 2023. The developer initially proposed 22 units, but the council wouldn't go for it. Lately, council members have told the owners of Junction Commons that their housing proposal is too large. Councilmember Canis Hart says he thinks of the Housing Authority's strategic plan as a toolkit rather than a commitment.
I'm going to judge each project on its own merits. And how does that project stand as far as whether it's code or whether it's a zone or a neighborhood plan or whatever the various factors are that we take into consideration.
Councilmember Roger Armstrong voted against the Housing Authority's strategies. He reiterated longstanding concerns about out-of-control growth and whether Summit County will be forced to stomach additional market-rate homes to subsidize affordable housing development.
So by approving this, we're saying, yes, we want this level of aggressiveness, and I will call it that, as it relates to housing.
Rezone requests, meanwhile, are stacking up around Kimball Junction. There is the Klein Dolly proposal, a future commercial center in Silver Creek, and potential housing along Rasmussen Road, in addition to the proposed outlet mall redevelopment. Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
So meteorologists are telling us that a super El Nino is approaching. On the phone to explain just what that is and the all-important potential implications for the upcoming ski season, we have Open Snow meteorologist Alan Smith. Morning, Alan. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Alan, let's start with terminology. What does the term El Nino refer to, and how does it differ from La Nina?
Yeah, so El Nino, essentially refers to sea surface temperatures compared to average in the eastern and central equatorial Pacific Ocean. And when we have an El Nino phase, it means that sea surface temperatures are warmer than average in this region in the central and eastern equatorial Pacific Ocean. And in an El Nino like this year, where you hear the phase strong or super El Nino, that means that temperatures are well above average in this region. And the La Nina, which is the opposite phase, it means that temperatures are, that sea surface temperatures are cooler than average in this region.
Okay. And what does this, how do you measure the strength of an El Nino?
So the strength is simply determined by how far from average the sea surface temperature anomalies are. So the warmer it is compared to average, the stronger an El Nino phase. And the same is true for the negative anomalies for a La Nina.
Mm-hmm. And you, I've heard the term, I think you've used the term, super El Nino. What does that mean?
Yes, so that means that temperature anomalies in this region are expected to be 2 degrees or more, 2 degrees Celsius or more above average for an extended amount of time in this region. And we have high confidence at this point that this is going to be the case heading into the winter season. And it's a pretty rare occurrence. It's only happened a handful of times in the past. And so that's why it's getting a lot of media attention.
So that's interesting. How do you know? What tools do you use to be able to project what's going to happen like that?
Yeah, there are monitors out in the ocean in this region that measure real-time temperatures. And then it's heavily modeled as well so that it can extrapolate it across the entire basin. And this particular ENSA region, since it's had so many implications on global climate for a long time, and the connection's been known for a long time, it's pretty heavily sampled as a result.
And so you take, basically what you're doing is you're taking existing readings, holding those up against historic readings and saying, this is what tells me about what is likely to come?
Yep, exactly. And it is also modeled into the future. So there's climate models that can project these sea surface temperature anomalies pretty far out into the future. I want to say 9 to 10 months into the future. And they do a pretty good job for the most part. And it's one of the more predictable long-range weather and climate measures compared to most things out there. It's not perfect, but it does a pretty good job. And the models sniffed out this current El Nino phase very well. They started projecting it back around December, January, and it's been pretty much spot on so far.
And how strong, how do we put this into relative terms? How strong does this one look compared to historic norms?
So the latest modeling is projecting this to potentially be the strongest on record. The latest forecast from the European seasonal model, which is typically the most accurate, has been projecting sea surface temperature anomalies reaching 3 to 4 degrees Celsius above average. So, and some model runs even a little above 4 degrees Celsius above average, which would pretty much blow away any records from the past. And at least since 1950, the strongest it's been has been closer to 2.5 degrees Celsius above average. There was another event in the late 1800s that was, some indications were that it was close to 3 degrees Celsius above average, but it's a little less reliable that far back in time. But at any rate, based on current modeling, this is looking like a potentially record-setting El Nino.
And I guess my understanding was that you get into the super category at 2 degrees centigrade, and now we're talking about 4. So this really does seem like it's an anomaly. Any understanding of what might cause this? I mean, why we're seeing this anomaly this year?
It's hard to say for sure. El Nino has had fluctuations in the past, and there's been some strong events in the past. Global ocean temperatures just as a whole are warmer now in the past, simply due to a warming climate. It's hard to say if that's responsible for this. It probably is playing a role, but there could just be other domino effect factors in the ocean and atmosphere that are causing it to happen, but it's hard to say for sure.
And zooming in on the fine print, I'm looking at a document that you prepared about could a super El Nino be the strongest ever? You talk about this as an emerging easterly based El Nino. What does that mean?
So that means that the sea surface and temperature anomalies are highest in the furthest east portion of the eastern equatorial Pacific, so right off the coast of South America. And since that article was published, we are still seeing the easterly base signature, but we've also seen significant warming in the central base as well. So I think it's really going to be kind
everywhere.
Of an overall.
Yeah,
it's going to be everywhere, exactly. the reason we make that designation, though, is some El Nino events turn out to be more central based, where the warming is stronger in the central, and those are termed Modoki El Ninos, and those can have different impacts on weather in North America compared to the more like classic East Base or full basin El Ninos.
So you've indicated that you're highly confident we're going to have this El Nino conditions throughout our winter this winter. I am highly confident that many of the people listening to this are saying to themselves, okay, guys, get on with it. What does this mean for our ski season? Well, that's the only reason we're listening. Talk to us a little bit about
that. Yeah, so during the stronger El Nino phases we've had in the past, it tends to produce a very strong southerly jet stream or a subtropical jet stream. So you tend to get stronger storms track across the southern United States. And in the west, this tends to have an impact on California and the southwest. But looking at these stronger episodes, it has a pretty good signal for Utah as well. It tends to favor above average snowfall in Utah. And while it's not a guarantee, every episode is different. Just taking all the data from the past and looking at it, it does tilt the odds in favor of above-average snowfall.
Talk to us about a couple of those seasons in the past where we've actually seen a super El Nino and what's happened here in Utah in terms of snow.
Right. So if we start chronologically, 1983 and 1982, 1983 winters and the 97-98 winters, those were both super El Ninos, and those were big winters for Utah, well above average snowfall. The last super El Nino was in 2015-2016, and that was more mixed. It was close to average snowfall. Still a pretty good winter, but not excessively above average like some of the others. Other strong El Ninos, we had a strong El Nino in 23-24. It was not a super El Nino, but it was a strong El Nino, and that ended up being slightly above average as well.
I was sure you were going to talk to us about 1877 through 1888. Which was also...
Yeah, not sure there was anybody around then.
Okay. How will we get updates on this going forward? Do you expect to sort of, further refine this as we get into the fall?
Yeah, at this point, it's mainly going to be just looking at some of the past El Nino episodes, looking at other factors in the oceans that could be adding to the picture of like this global overall pattern. Like ENSO is what we use for the El Nino Southern Oscillation. So that describes El Nino or La Nina, basically. So while a strong El Nino is what we're looking at the most this year, where we also look at temperature anomalies and other parts of the Pacific and Atlantic oceans and how that can shape the overall pattern. So really it's just taking a look at those and seeing how it's going to fit together in the entire puzzle. As far as updates, we're pretty confident in the super El Nino at this point, and it's just going to be a matter of looking at these other small scale factors and how it can affect the forecast. And in Open Snow, we're actually going to be publishing our winter forecast next week on Wednesday, August 12th. So if you're listening, stay tuned for that.
Okay, if people who are listening are certainly interested in whether we're going to have a good snowfall year, how will they be able to access Open Snow's new forecast next week?
You can go to, if you're on the web, you can go to opensnow.com and go to Explore and News, and that's going to be an article that's available to anyone, regardless of if you're a subscriber or not. If you're on our email list, this will also be emailed to you next Wednesday. If you have the Open Snow app downloaded, the best way to find this, pull up the app, tap on the Explore tab, and scroll down there's a news section. So if you look under recent news, you can tap on that and you'll see this article.
And without jumping the gun on next week's news, can you at least share with us whether it's an optimistic forecast or not?
For Utah, it's an optimistic forecast.
Okay.
We always try to be careful when we paint areas that are favored for above average snowfall. It's like, look, it's not a guarantee. It's just historically the odds tilted more in favor of this direction. And, you know, we would tell anybody the same year with a below average projection. It doesn't necessarily mean you're doomed. It's just the odds are tilted in that direction.
We've been talking to meteorologist Alan Smith. Alan, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
I think that pretty well covers it.
All right. Thanks for spending time with us this morning. And we'll all be, I know I'll be looking at Open Snow on Wednesday to see what we can expect this winter.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for having me.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
The Park City School District has removed all hazardous soil from the Treasure Mountain Sports Complex construction site. KPCW's Christine Weller reports other soil will be reburied.
The Park City School District told KPCW Thursday that hazardous soil from the Treasure Mountain Sports Complex is gone. The soil was dug up during construction. The district is building soccer fields, tennis courts, and a softball and baseball field where Treasure Mountain Junior High previously stood. While soil piles remain on site, Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman said all the hazardous material has been removed. That's the soil exceeding the Toxicity Characteristic Leaching Procedure, or TCLIP, threshold, a test designed to determine whether something contains potentially harmful waste. Huntsman said the TCLIP soil was sent to a landfill south of Provo. Other site soil will be used to create a berm around the softball and baseball fields.
The remaining soil that did not fail TCLIP and is allowed to remain on site is being buried, capped, clean fill will be brought in, and then it will be landscaped over.
That soil is contaminated with traces of lead and arsenic from Park City's mining days. The Utah Department of Environmental Quality said the soil is not considered hazardous. Huntsman said it's expected to be reburied in the fall.
As with all construction projects, you know, there's unforeseen issues that arise that delay the project, but we're hopeful by the end of October.
That's in line with the expected construction end date. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
In the studio, I have Brian Boudreaux, and on the phone, I have Olympian Kristen Santos Griswold. We're here to talk about Park City speed skating. Morning, Brian. Morning, Kristen. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Okay, Brian, let's start with you. Give us a little bit of history and background on Park City speed skating.
Yeah, Park City speed skating's actually been around since 2006 when the rink opened, and I actually used to compete and skated in their first meet a long time ago. And fast forward to 2020, and with COVID, the club actually halted operations. And myself and Rob Kramer, who actually knew each other from 20 years ago in Boston, inline racing.
I can hear the Boston, by the way.
And we actually separately came together and showed up the first night. This was December before the last, well, two Olympics ago, 2021, and restarted the team.
Okay, and it's explain what it is. It's a club team. Tell me how you function.
We right now skate once a week on Monday nights, 6:30 to 7:45. We've been trying to get a second night of ice, but in this town, it's really tough. And I don't know if you've heard about the push for this talk of a new ice sheet at the rink, and that would really help the community and bring people to Park City and bring a lot of economic benefit to Park City if we did have another ice sheet. But I also run dry land once a week, and we try to get down to the oval once a week. So we have possibly 2 days of ice a week and dry
land. And Kristen, how long have you been involved?
I just started getting involved, but it's a really great group of people, and it's super fun. And I think just in general, like, speed skating is such a tight-knit community, and you get to meet people from all over the country, and it's really cool and fun, you know, when you have a friend from the East Coast or wherever it is. And yeah, I think just Utah in general is home to the national team and the fastest ice on earth. So what, there's literally no better place to get started.
Okay. Hey, Brian, you might want to put on a set of headphones. Is there a set of headphones over there for you? Yes, you can hear Kristen. There you go. Otherwise, hard to keep up with the conversation. Again, you mentioned ice time. Is that really the limiting factor? If you guys had access to another night, would you be able to, you know, get people to practice in it?
Yeah, I think it would help us compete because we're trying to compete against the Oval team, and they skate 3 to 6 times a week.
So I was going to say, who do you compete against? Yes. In other words, what kind of a network is there for this kind of speed skating?
This is the place to be. I mean, if you're a speed skater, this is the place. I mean, Kristen, I moved here in 2000 to come skate. Kristen, I know, moved from the East Coast to come skate here. I mean, the best coaches are here. The best facilities in the world are here, so...
Were you both competitive speed skaters in your career?
I mean, I started really late. Kristen's at a whole nother level. I mean, I just met Kristen helping out, and there's actually a Desert Classic going on right now, which she's coaching her niece from Alaska, and one of our skaters, Flynn Thomas. And 2 years ago, she was just dominant. I mean, I didn't know her and watched her skate. I mean, she beat probably half of the men's national team at this meet. I mean, she's an amazing talent and just really humble. And what I like about speed skating is that it's a team sport. People don't realize, no. I mean, I'm sure Kristen would understand this. You need a good team around you, and all the speed skaters support each other.
That's an interesting point you make, because I think my perception at least, is that speed skating would be very individual. Like, it's you against the world. But Kristen, explain to us why you think the team element is so important.
Well, yeah, so it's a weird aspect because it is an individual sport in the aspect of, like, when you go and you step on the race line, you're there for racing for yourself. But it really takes a team behind you to get there and to be able to perform. During every single practice, having a team is something that, like, they motivate you, they keep it fun, you push each other. And in speed skating, especially short track, you need to know how to race, you need to know how to follow people, make passes, do all of that stuff. And that's the kind of thing that you practice during practice, and you need a team to be able to do that. But yeah, like, speed skating's hard. It's not easy, and you know, your legs will be burning, and having someone there who's motivating you and cheering you on and keeping you going is honestly a necessity.
You know, we hear a lot about what I would call the farm team, the process by which Olympic teams are developed. Talk to us a little bit about how our Olympic speed skating teams develops, and how do groups like yours play a role in that? Brian?
Go
ahead, Kristen.
Oh, I was just going to say that, like we said, Utah is honestly the place to be. It's the hub for speed skating in the U.S. And also, like I said, the fastest ice on earth. So I think what happens often is a lot of people come from club teams and eventually make their way to Utah to train. And, you know, regardless of where you're training, you get to know people throughout the country at races. Especially a lot of people are coming here to Utah for races. So you become friends with everyone, and then eventually they become your full-time teammates often. And yeah, I think it's just kind of this stepping stone of comfortability that you make with each other and friendly competitiveness.
And
No, I just wanted to say something. In case people don't know who Kristen is, Kristen 2 years ago won the world championships, which is amazing, especially with, in the history of short track, she's probably the greatest female skater that we've seen. The Koreans and Chinese are just amazing. And in the United States, it's really difficult. We don't get the kind of support financially that these other nations do. And what Kristen's accomplished is just amazing.
They break up an interesting point. Go ahead, Kristen. You bring up an interesting point, which is the financial support. And that's really what I was trying to ask about, which is the network by which we create a national team. I take it that in contrast to some of the other sports, there's not a lot of sort of financial support reaching down to support these people who want to train to become Olympians.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what Kristen's situation is, but when I was training, there were people on the national team on food stamps, trying to get housing. I mean, some of the most talented skaters around, and they're struggling to survive.
And, you know, for those of us who only pay attention to this every 4 years, just briefly, what are the major speed skating competitions? What are the events?
Go ahead, Kristen.
Oh, yeah. So during each season, we have, it used to be 6 World Tour events. Now, this upcoming year, it's 7. And then following years, we're going to move it up to 8. And then there's a World Championships at the end of the year. So we have, you know, quite a few major races throughout the year. And I would say World Championships especially is almost like our Olympics every year.
And just for, again, what are the different events within speed skating? I take it they're different lengths of races?
Go ahead.
Yeah, and at World Tours, we have, and World Championships and the Olympics, we have those 500 meters, which is 4.5 laps around the ice. That's our all-out sprint. The 1,000 meters, which is 9 laps. The 1,500 meters, which is 13.5 laps. And then we have a couple relays. So there's a women's relay where 4 women compete together and it's 3,000 meters. And then a men's relay, which is 5,000 meters of 4 men competing together. And then a mixed gender team relay, which is 2 women and 2 men. Yeah. And they're doing 2,000 meters.
So again, just to give us a sense of 13.5 laps, about how long, what would a competitive time be for a 13.5 half lap race?
Just a little.
Roughly a little over 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Wow.
And there used to be a 3,000, but I guess that's been phased out, huh, Kristen?
Yeah. We don't do that one anymore.
All right, well, let's talk about some new things that are happening at Park City Speed Skating. You are rebranding the Learn to Race program. Why the rebrand, Brian?
We just want to just get kids to go fast. I mean, that's basically what speed skating is. And if you haven't seen it, there's some elite competitors from all over the world today racing at 2:00 at the Oval. And you stop by there for a couple hours and you'll see, unless you've seen this sport in person, you have no idea how fast it is. I played college hockey at UMass Boston, and the first time I got on the ice, I might have been doing 12-second laps, and I couldn't believe how fast I was going. And to get a sense of the speed, the top hockey player, I can't think of his name, from Edmonton, he's the fastest guy in the NHL. Probably a 9-year-old or 10-year-old, 9-year-old girl could beat him.
Speed skaters, just with the
equipment. Mm-hmm. The equipment makes the speed unbelievable. And as far as this class, it's we're going to have a 6-week session. And Nathaniel Mills had been running our Learn to Speed Skate. He moved to Park City a couple of years ago. And he's a 3-time Olympian and actually has won a world medal in 1991. And yeah, he's been coaching our Learn to Speed Skate, but right now we have Kristen and Anna Quinn that are going to help us out, and possibly Julie Latai the end of the month when Anna's away, to run this Learn to Race clinic. And it's Monday night, 6:30 to 7:45. You can go to our website. It's parkcityspeedskate.club. and all the information is there. If you're a hockey player, figure skater, and you like to go fast, or if you're a hockey player and you don't like to get hit, this is the sport for you.
Okay, so who is your target audience? What age ranges are you shooting for and for this program?
Just 5 or 6 to, I don't know, 76. We would like to get some adults skating, too. It's a great cross-training. It's a low impact. I'm 60 now and keeps me in shape a couple times a week. It's good for your muscles, balance.
Okay, so it's not sort of a training farm for... necessarily a training farm for people who want to get into serious competition. It can be just people who want to get out and skate.
Yeah, I'd like to see some adults just skating laps, because we could have a group doing that, and also kids. I mean, if you want to be an Olympian with 2034, I mean, this is the place to be. If you're a young kid and you have that drive.
Do you have some kids that you think might be able to be in that category?
Yeah, right now, Flynn Thomas is racing down at the Oval, and he just started not that long ago, and he qualified for nationals, which was amazing.
How old is he?
He's 10.
Wow.
And there's time standards for qualification, and he's competing against kids that are training, in my mind, too much at too young an age. You know, they're training like 5-6 days a week. I mean, and the East Coast is... there's a Korean culture and Chinese culture that it's just hard work, and they put the time in.
Now, you've got a pretty amazing coaching staff. You've talked about Kristen, who has got a pretty incredible resume. Kristen, who else is on the coaching staff, and tell us a little about them.
Yeah, so we also are going to have Anna Quinn, who is primarily a long track skater, which is actually really great to have in short track as someone teaching you, because she's done both. And long trackers know how to do straightaways really well, where short trackers primarily know how to do corners really well. So being able to have both people coaching you is going to be really beneficial. And then we'll also have Julie Letai, who is another 2-time Olympian.
And so this sounds to me like the kind of coaching staff that you would only find here in Park City, in terms of the quality of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, so what equipment is required, and what's the cost to participate?
It's $186 for a 6-week session. We provide helmets if you don't have a helmet. You should wear long pants. We have speed skates, and we also recommend gloves. And knee pads are optional, but I'd recommend them. Trace knee pads are for volleyball. They're sort of hard to find. And that's about it. Just show up. And we just do ask that people have a basic balance and able to do a crossover, you know. And there is Learn to Skate programs at the ice arena. And
this is not that.
it's a learn to speed skate, but you should have at least a basic knowledge of crossovers and how to stand up.
And what's your season? I mean, you mentioned this is a 6-week program. What do you guys do year-round?
Yeah, so normally the speed skating season, we didn't start this year till middle of June, but as Kristen probably knows, they start, it's pretty much May to the end of March. It's a long season.
Okay. Yeah.
And Kristen, are you going to continue to compete on the world stage?
Yeah, I will be. This year, being the year after the Olympics, I might not be at every single race, but I do plan to be at some and hopefully increase more. I'm also in school, so this year I'm a little bit more focused on finishing my degree, but I'm still training regularly and going to be competing.
Okay, anything else you want to touch on before we go? And where can people learn more? Go ahead, Brian.
So, Kristen, I thought you had graduated college a long time ago.
No, I'm in my. Graduated with my undergrad.
Oh, okay, that's what
I
thought.
I'm in my doctorate right now, yeah.
Yeah, what people don't realize is, Kristen, a lot of skaters, they're out of the sport by 19. Kristen went to college and then improved through her 20s and actually won the Worlds in her late 20s, which is amazing.
All right, website?
Park City Speed Skate. Club. And then I'd also like to thank our sponsors, Park City Ice Arena, Youth United, the Wyatt Youth Sports Alliance, and Pit Viper and Pale Blue, who support us.
Brian Boudreau and Kristen Santos-Griswold, thanks for spending time with us.